fundamental question that is faced by sports is, do they want, will the industry ever allow somebody to tell the truth on the air? But I don't think that today that will ever happen again. I don't think the industry will allow it.
All right, baby, it's time to roll. Let's roll, baby. We rollin'!
Live from the hotbed of mixed martial arts in Las Vegas, your host, pro MMA expert Larry Pepe, takes you into the completely uncut world of MMA. Warning, not for the faint of heart. Pro MMA Radio is not responsible for any side effects, which may include extreme excitement, increased adrenaline levels, and a sudden desire to kick ass. Are you ready? Larry, let's do it.
Welcome to Pro MMA Radio, the official radio show of the American Forces Network, proudly heard in over 170 countries and brought to you by Cytosport Monster Milk. I'm your host, Larry Pepe, UFC 220 and Bellator's latest offering, all in the books, three titles up for grabs. We'll tell you how many changed hands in just a bit. We'll also revisit the Uriah Hall and Robert Whittaker situations that we told you about last week. And we have more actual data about UFEC's self-proclaimed best year ever. Numbers be damned. But first, let's get to our announcements. UFC on Fox 28 will now get a main event of Jeremy Stephens on a quick turnaround after him annihilating Doohoo Choi versus Josh Emmett after him annihilating Ricardo Lamas. So an interesting main event with big implications at 145 pounds. The Fox event after that gets a can't-miss main event as well. Justin Gaethje versus Dustin Poirier. But the big news this week, UFC 223, April in Brooklyn, will get a main event of Khabib Nurmagomedov versus Tony Ferguson for a title. Now, I know what you're thinking. Is it for the interim title? Is it for the real title? I don't know. Because Dana White was specifically asked at the press conference that they did if this was for the Undisputed Championship and if McGregor would be stripped. Quoting, "I have no update. The winner of this fight will be the champion." Then when he was asked again later on, he said about whether McGregor had been stripped, he said, "Next question." So this ridiculous dance is going on that proves that Dana White is scared to death of Conor McGregor. He won't say that it's for the real belt. He says that whoever wins is going to be the champion. He also said during the week before the announcement that Conor's talking about coming back in August or September, and they can't hold everybody up that long, etc., which would suggest it's for the real belt. Then he said, quote, "Listen, I take so much blank for how much I like Conor McGregor and everything else, but the division has to go on. They're going to fight for the title. This is the real title. I said Conor can't hold up the title for 2 years." So first of all, he should take a lot of crap for the way that he deals with McGregor, not because he likes him, but because he bends over backwards to please the guy, often to the exclusion of entire divisions in the UFC. But when he says this is the real title, but then he won't say that McGregor is being stripped, you can't have two belts, two real belts, in one division. As it is, they have divisions that are littered with the real belt, the interim belt, and all that crap. So strip him, and if Conor ever decides he wants to fight again, he gets the next shot as soon as he comes back. But the idea that you would go to a press conference and be this asinine, that you're refusing to answer the obvious question, and you're not, you're saying whoever wins will be the champion Well, sure. Tony Ferguson's a champion right now on paper. He's the interim champion. So if whoever wins, are they going to be the interim champion, the real champion, the undisputed champion? My guess is that whoever wins is going to be called the real champion, as they should. I mean, there's no question about that. These are the two best lightweights in the world. These are the two most deserving in the world. But the idea that he won't say it at a public press conference when he's announcing the fight and dances all around it and makes himself look like a fool is somewhat comical. Not as comical as John Kavanaugh. Listen, I know Kavanaugh is McGregor's coach. I know this is the same guy who said that McGregor was going to knock Mayweather out in, I can't remember if it was two rounds initially, and then he downgraded it to one, or was it four rounds, and he downgraded it to two? There was so much stupidity coming out of the McGregor camp about what they were going to do to Mayweather, whether it was Owen Roddy or it was John Kavanaugh. It's hard for me to keep track of who said what. But he went on to say he clearly thinks that Habib is going to beat Ferguson, which I agree with. But then he went on to say in a Conor versus Habib fight, quote, "I find it hard to visualize anything else other than Conor knocking him out." Think about that. Hard to visualize anything but Conor knocking him out. After seeing what Habib does to everybody they put in front of him, takes him down and murders them on the ground. Hard to see that. Then he said, quote, "We have to be ready because he's shown he can walk through some shots and there will be those grappling exchanges. So we've got to be in incredible shape, in great shape. We've got to be totally ready for his chain wrestling and how he puts his takedowns together. I think Conor's striking with his submission game as well would cause problems." Yeah, sure. Conor's submission game is going to cause problems for Habib. I can't even say it with a straight face. And on our announcements, I don't have an announcement about Darren Till or Michael Bisping being booked for the UFC London card, which we are only 2 months away from. And that should tell you all you have to know about how ineffective this promotion can be. 2 months out, Darren Till, an absolute, I believe, a superstar in the making. No booking yet. Don't even know if he's on the card. And Bisping's retirement fight is on the card. And we're 2 months out and don't know about either of those fighters. All right, let's turn our attention back to UFC 221. We told you last week that Robert Whittaker is out, and instead, Luke Rockhold will now take on Yoel Romero. And of course, it is for a worthless interim belt. So Yoel Romero's coming off a loss and getting an interim title shot, and the loss was to the champion. Whittaker will have only not defended for 7 months at the time of the interim. I say only because you look at other situations where fighters hold divisions hostage for a year or two with injuries and everything else. 7 months, and yet another interim. So this is all the bad stuff that they avoided from boxing, where you have so many belts that nobody cares about belts anymore, and they are continuing to do it and will continue to do it. And we hoped when UFC 220 was booked with Nagano Stipe, which is completely legit, the right fight to happen. When 221 was booked with Rockhold and Whittaker, again, legit, the right fight to happen. You could have deluded yourself into thinking maybe UFEC has figured out that running the entertainment angle first rather than following any sense of athletic divisional integrity is the way to go. And then you realize, no, that was just a coincidence. They're still entertainment-based first. And let's take up how utterly disrespectful this is to Robert Whittaker. You hold him as an interim champion after he beats Jacare and Romero, who Michael Bisping, with a gun to his head, would not want any part of either one of them. And you have Whittaker in the interim slot. you ice the division for a year so you can do GSP Bisping. Then you promote Whitaker to the full champion when GSP vacates. And then when he can't take this first fight, you create an interim. And he could be a potential star with the right marketing. And they are just devaluing this guy as fast as they possibly can. He's an exciting fighter, great stand-up, knocks people out, rarely in a boring fight, doesn't have any big problems that we know of, or gets into trouble all the time, or all this other stuff. And now, icing on the cake, they have set up a situation where if Romero beats Rockhold, you have a horrible rematch between Romero and Whitaker. So Whitaker's first title defense could be a rematch against the guy he beat for the interim belt. It is asinine. For Yoel Romero's part, he is suing Gold Star. That is the supplement company that he claims made the tainted supplement. He claims it's tainted, called Shred X, that he claims caused him to fail a drug test and get a 6-month suspension. So put him on the short list of fighters who actually claimed a tainted supplement and followed through and filed a lawsuit. Unlike, for example, John Jones with the lab that created, or that the generic Cialis that happened to be laced with PEDs came from, unlike so many other fighters. Josh Barnett, we brought him up last week, says he will not negotiate with UBADA and will probably get 4 years. So here's the backdrop. Apparently, they offered him a 2-year sentence. He balked and said, no, I'd rather you test my supplements. Then he gave him the supplements. This is his story. According to him, they said that the supplements, in fact, came back tainted and then came back to him with the same 2-year sentence. And when he balked at that, they knocked it down to 18 months. He felt that he proved his lack of intent to cheat with the supplements, thought that he would get, you know, time served, maybe educate other fighters, whatever, about tainted supplements. And it does raise the question, why does Romero get 6 months for a tainted supplement and Barnett get 24 and then 18? Tim Means got 9 months, as I recall, for the exact same substance, which apparently he failed for Osterine. Now, according to Josh, he said that after working with USADA, that the positive was linked to a supplement he took containing Tribulus terrestris, which is a natural testosterone booster. But why would that trigger a positive for Osterine? So that doesn't make any sense to me. Quoting Barnett, I end up, no matter what, at the mercy of USADA, and to be honest, I don't trust them in any way, shape, or form. I have no interest to work with them or be part of their program. I would be willing to do anything else but work with USADA at this point. When you can't trust someone, what are you supposed to do? To continue to give them the opportunity to break your trust? They don't seem responsible enough to have oversight over my career. I'm not against the idea and spirit of USADA or what an independent drug testing program is. I'm okay with having to go through the process to test the supplements. The only thing I protest to is being hammered after the fact, after finding out that I'm innocent of any wrongdoing. Again, these are his words. And instead of moving on and considering the time spent researching and finding the data and appealing my case as enough, the extra efforts to come after me, that's where I draw the line. And he went on to say that he thinks they're more interested in punishing people to make themselves look like a more effective program, etc. Listen, Josh has a history of failing drug tests before USADA, so you have to take things with a grain of salt. But I do ask the question, if he's telling the truth, this is his version, USADA hasn't spoken about it, if he's telling the truth and they in fact found a tainted supplement, I don't get the Tribulus Osterine connection, I have no idea what that's about, but if they came to the conclusion, they, USADA, that he did not intentionally take anything and the supplement was tainted, why do we have these wildly varied time frames. Why does he get approached with 24 months and negotiates it down to 18, but Tim Means for the same substance gets 9, and Yoel Romero on a tainted supplement for a different substance gets 6? The lack of uniformity is really perfect because it's exactly what UFEC does when they play fast and loose with their own rules or who's getting stripped or who's doing an interim, and they do things just as they see fit. But you would hope, although your hopes would be dashed, that in a drug testing program, things would be handled different. And another failure comes in. Cynthia Cavillo fails an in-competition drug test at UFC 219 for marijuana. So both UBATA and the also worthless Nevada State Athletic Commission have jurisdiction over that one. And last but not least, one more announcement. Bellator added to their broadcast booth with Jay Glazer. I think it's a mistake. I know he's good on football. I know he's got a reputation in football, but the work I've seen from him in MMA has been, in a word, terrible.
This is Cain Velasquez, and you're listening to Pro MMA Radio.
All right, let's take a look back at last week's fight night, because there were some storylines coming out of there that I wanted to address, and some came out after we did last week's show, and some we simply didn't have enough time to get to. First, Dana White slams Kamaru Usman, which really, if you think about it, is exactly what you want to do with a 7-0 prospect in the welterweight division who you're refusing to promote. He said, quote, "I didn't love that fight. Yeah, he's a tough guy. Yeah, he can impose his will. But you don't jump up and start acting like you knocked somebody out and say you only went 30%. So what's that mean? What if you're on pay-per-view? Do you use 60%? You just fought a guy who wasn't ranked and went to a decision, and the people were booing you at the end. I don't think that's the right time to call a guy out when they're booing you out of the stadium," end quote. And Usman explained on Twitter that when he talked about the 30%, he meant that he had been ill and was fighting at 30% of his capability because of an illness. What I find kind of interesting is two things. Number one, quoting Dana White, "You just fought a guy who wasn't ranked and went to a decision." Hey, genius, whose fault was it that he was fighting an unranked opponent? Because this ridiculous fight that should have never happened, and I, by your words, kind of, you must think the same because you're pointing out that he's fighting an unranked guy, it fell out and they rebooked it. So whose fault is it that he was fighting an unranked opponent? That's number one. Number two, it is amazing that unless your name is McGregor, unless your name is Rousey, unless you have maybe a couple of other names, the kid who smoked weed on Dana White's Contender Series, I can't even remember his name, with the curly hair, unless you're somebody he likes and he wants to push, he has no hesitancy crapping all over potential headliners. Usman is no bum. He's 7-0. He's maybe the biggest threat to Woodley. I think him and Covington is a hell of a fight. But Dana apparently forgets that he is a promoter. Vitor Belfort, not happy either. Quote, "A message to the UFC now. I'm waiting for my paycheck. I did what I had to do, trained, was there on fight week, made weight. Where's the respect? It's hard to understand after all the dedication and sacrifice, preparing mentally to retire from a sport I basically helped create, and that simply doesn't happen. I have mixed feelings about what happened." And Dana's response was that they offered him a short notice replacement that he turned down and offered him a fight at UFC 220. Now, with all due respect, I don't care who you offered him. He showed up, made weight. He doesn't have to take a replacement fight against someone he has not trained or prepared for. He still should get, at a minimum, his show money. Every fighter should get their show money, whether or not you accepted whoever they threw at you literally the day before a fight. And to suggest otherwise is as if you know nothing about fighting. Like, the opponent doesn't matter. Preparation doesn't matter. Fight styles don't matter. And they're doing that to a guy who anyone who listens to this show knows I am not an advocate for Vitor Belfort. Not at all. But to be fair and honest, I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's a fighter I respect or a fighter I can't stand or somebody in the middle. If you show up, you do your job, and through no fault of your own, you do not fight. Guess what? You need to get paid. And again, just to deal with uniformity, on Twitter, at SmoogieMMA, wrote the following. Remember, UFC fighters, if your fight gets canceled last minute, depending on Dana's mood or the size of your purse, you may receive your show and win money. That was Rose Namajunas versus Ansaroff. Just your show money. That was Tim Elliott. A portion of your show money. That was Tony Ferguson. Or nothing. And that was Vitor Belfort. So, again, no uniformity. Just whatever we feel like doing, whenever we feel like doing it. Now let's get to the Uriah Hall situation. Apparently, he fainted on the way to weigh-ins, had to go to the hospital, stayed there overnight, etc., etc. The chorus of the UFC has to do something, someone's going to die, blah, 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 of course, permeated the MMA media and the MMA Twitter sphere. Of course, the idea of having weight classes every pound permeated, which, look, you know what? Why don't we just adopt all the boxing weight classes so it's easier for Zuffa Boxing to keep track of it all? And by the way, if I haven't made it clear, and I think I have, after Dana's proclamations about everyone he hates in boxing, I'm as convinced as I've ever been, and I know I said this on the show over a month ago, that if he gets into boxing, you will see him pay for, take on, or partner with a significant portion of Al Heyman's fighters, because Heyman is hemorrhaging money with PBC. And he's basically ruled out working with everybody else. And that's the direction I see it going. And that will create, you watch, dissension up and down this MMA roster when some of those boxers who are not as well known as some of these MMA fighters are making way more money. All right. So speaking of Twitter, at Mike Bond MMA tweeted the following, and Derek Gray, one of our Truth Army members on Facebook, sent me the following stat. In the 18 months leading up to the implementation of the early weigh-ins for MMA, a total of 17 fighters missed weight. In the 18 months since, 51 fighters have missed weight or failed to weigh in for UFC bouts. So the number has tripled from what it was. These are numbers, 18 months before, 18 months since. Now, is anyone with a brain going to say, hey, wait a minute, that has nothing to do with anything? Because if you're saying that, your brain is not functioning at all, because those numbers don't lie. And when you really kind of put a fine point, I saw an article where there was discussion that the MMA fighters are figuring it out. Them and their camps are figuring out the timing. We're 18 months in. 18 months in, and it happens just as much now as before. So does it make sense that if there was a system before where it happened a fraction of the time, then mature people, instead of looking for every other reason and instead of ignoring what's in front of them or their egos being too big to admit that they made a huge mistake, would say, you know what, we tried this, we've done it for 18 months, it's not working, and we're going to go back to what we did before because we had much less of this problem, so we're going to put that system back in place. The numbers don't lie, and it's not a coincidence. Taking the hours up to 4 p.m., now fighters are weighing in the morning, let's just say on an average 10, 11 o'clock before they were weighing in at 4. When you're cutting those last pounds, that 5 or 6 or 7 hours is everything. Otherwise, you wouldn't see so many fighters barely make weight at 4 p.m. in the past. And those fighters that were struggling to make it by 4 p.m. in the past are, in many cases, that's the person who can't make it in the morning. So it makes no sense. I also was sent a tweet by Julian at B-A-I-H-U-J on Twitter, forwarding me something that Ian Kidd from Bloody Elbow had tweeted, quote, the IV ban has nothing to do with guys missing weight. An IV can't help you cut weight. This take is silly and needs to die. Not to mention, there's no evidence of the number of fighters missing weight going up after the IV ban, only after early morning weigh-ins, end quote. Ian's right. I know he's not referring to me. I have never said that the IV ban has anything to do with cutting weight. It doesn't. It has to do with proper rehydration afterwards. I have argued against both. Let's not get it twisted or confused. I have argued against both early weigh-ins, unless they're put back to 48 hours, because that is what the medical evidence shows you need for full and proper rehydration without an IV. And I have argued for the institution of IVs to give them back to the fighters, because it is, last time I checked, the medically appropriate way to deal with dehydration. Otherwise, when you show up at an emergency room, they'd hand you some Pedialyte instead of sticking a needle in your arm and giving you an IV. And to be crystal clear, in case anybody is still confused, I have long argued that what they should do is let the fighters IV, and the promotion should provide the IV. It's a $4 billion company in the UFC's case. Bellator is making plenty of money too. They're owned by Viacom, that's worth a gazillion dollars. At the weigh-ins, fighters should be given IVs for a four-hour period after they weigh in. It wouldn't cost that much to have a nurse or two there to do that. Then you would know exactly what's going in their body, so there'd be no banned substances being administered by IVs. And anyone who wanted an IV would have to take a test, a drug test, right before the IV was administered. You give your blood, you give your urine, whatever the case is, whatever test they want to do. And then there's no argument, as stupid as the argument is, that Ubata tries to make, that, well, cyclists use this to mass drugs. We know that is not what's happening here. These fighters are dehydrated because they cut weight. But as stupid as that argument is, it goes away completely, because if you test them right before you give them the IV, they can't be masking with the IV because you already have what you need to perform the test. And ironically, Jeff Fulovitsky outed himself that when saying that with the CBD and Nate's case, that he told them, well, you already took his test, so you already know what's in his system when he fought. Well, it's the same argument. Same argument. Do the test, and then you don't have to be concerned about what the IV is or isn't masking, because they can't mask it because you just tested them before you gave them the IV. So in case I haven't been crystal clear, which I know I have, that should clarify exactly where I stand on early weigh-ins and IVs.
This is former heavyweight champion Randy the Natural Couture, and you're listening to Pro MMA Radio.
So Dana White did an interview last week and was asked whether he thought Floyd didn't try for the early part of the fight and carried Connor. And he said, no way. He has way too much power, meaning Connor. Floyd wouldn't just let him hit him, blah, blah, blah. Of course he carried him. Anybody watching who knows what's going on knows he carried him, knows that he just let him punch himself out because he knows he has no cardio. But then he said this gem: I'm not interested in a rematch. I definitely do it in the octagon. Okay, now think about this. This is a guy who says that he's going into boxing promotion, and he has no interest in a rematch. Not that it's going to happen, but I'm just saying. He has no interest in a rematch of what he said was the biggest combat sports event on pay-per-view in history. And if we believe the publicly traded company with lawyers who can't put out fake numbers, meaning Showtime, it was by a narrow margin the second best in history. So you're a promoter and you have no interest in promoting a rematch of the second biggest boxing event in history. And by the way, that would mean that you have no interest in generating more money for UFEC? Really? I mean, assuming that you can't get Conor back in the octagon, because once Habib annihilates Tony Ferguson, I don't see Conor running to come back. I hope I'm wrong, because I'd love to see the fight. I just don't see it happening. But regardless, he also goes on to say that Conor McGregor has $100 million in the bank. Floyd has $300 million. If you think Floyd only has three times the money that Conor has, you're insane. And no, Conor doesn't have $100 million in the bank based on the numbers we've gone through before. And then the hosts of this program and Dana agree that if Floyd fought Conor in the octagon, it would be bigger than the first fight. So let me get this straight. A fight that everybody knows Floyd would get murdered in no time flat, for the simple reason that disciplines would be used that he knows nothing about and is completely incompetent at. That's going to outsell the boxing match that was the second biggest pay-per-view in combat sports history. Then Dana goes on to talk about Habib fighting the Brazilian and doesn't remember Edson Barboza's name. And then he drops this gem in pure Dinocchio style that Conor is always the underdog. So I went back and looked. He's fought 10 times in the UFC, and he was the favorite 9 times when he walked in the cage. 9 out of 10. In fact, he was a 14-1 favorite over Dennis Seaver. And against Aldo, he opened in the favorite as the favorite and closed as a very slight underdog when Aldo came in the cage at minus 135. So completely untrue. That made me think of, and we got some more statistics this week about what Dana claims was the UFC's, quote, best year ever. So here are the numbers. Very in-depth article on ratings and all this type of thing was done by Dave Meltzer. And in 2016, UFC did 13 pay-per-views, 8.21 million estimated buys, an average of 632,000 per show. In 2017, they did 12 pay-per-views with an average of 309,000. So a 51% decline per show. The pay-per-view prelims viewership was down 29%. Their live gates in 2016, they did 11 pay-per-views, grossed $60 million, roughly $5.5 million a show. In 2017, they did 10, grossed $26.8 million, roughly $2.7 million per show. That is also a 51% decline from the year before. In the last 10 years, 2017 pay-per-view live gates were the second worst of any year, and the average pay-per-view buys were the worst since 2005. So their pay-per-view business was trash compared to the year before. So you might be thinking, well, maybe everybody just save their money and watch the free TV events. No. UFC on Fox, down 21.7% from the year before, and four of the four shows that they did in 2017 were four of the worst five in the history of the seven-year relationship. FS1 live events, down 17.6%. Fight night prelims, down 13%. So when you really look at all the numbers, I understand that they can look at how many jobs they slashed, how much money they saved, and the last year of the Fox contract, the money went up. But you're going to be hard-pressed to find anyone else who would look at the numbers and statistics, hard numbers and statistics and decline and percentages, who with a straight face could say that that is your best year ever when it was dwarfed by the year right before. And in the midst of all that, in the midst of their pay-per-view business being, I believe I just said, the worst since 2005, their average pay-per-view buys, they decided to raise the price of pay-per-views for UFC 220, and it looks like the foreseeable future, it will now be $54.95 for regular and $64.95 for HD, so $5 per event, which is an amazing business decision. You get destroyed on pay-per-view, have one of the worst years you've ever had, and raise your prices, and you do it on a card that is more top-heavy than Dolly Parton. Amazing. And we're going to tell you what happened on that very card next.
Hey, this is John Jones, and I listen to Pro MMA Radio.
All right, let's take a look at UFC 220, where it was N-Still times 2. Let me say up front that I could not have been more wrong about the Francis Ngannou-Stipe Miocic fight. I thought I got sucked in by the vicious, almost decapitation-like power of Ngannou. I paired that in my head with seeing Stipe Miocic basically knocked out against Alistair Overeem before he came back and finished Overeem. And I thought that Ngannou's takedown defense, his physicality, his agility from an athletic standpoint would make it too difficult for Stipe to bail himself out with his wrestling when he was in trouble on the feet. Turns out, none of that was the case. Ngannou, in the first round, landed a couple of big shots. Nothing that looked like it landed completely flush. I thought Stipe was getting the better of the striking exchanges. He landed on Ngannou a couple of times flush, and then the takedowns began. And Ngannou, by the second round, was tired. By the third round, he was completely exhausted. I thought Miocic fought literally the perfect fight. He didn't get caught with anything flush. Whenever he was in trouble, there was, I believe it was in the third or fourth round, it was one of the two. Ngannou landed a big shot, looked like Stipe was in trouble, chased after him. Stipe took him down with ease again. Ngannou's takedown defense and his cardio are two, I'll call them gaping holes in his game. Of course, we haven't had the opportunity to see that. And as an analyst, again, I was wrong. I should not have fallen in love with Ngannou's power so much as to ignore that he really has not been tested in the wrestling department, and he really has not been tested in the cardio department. Well, he was tested in both, and he failed miserably. He also failed miserably at any evidence of any grappling savvy when he was on the ground. When he was underneath Stipe, the commentators accurately pointed out that it really seemed like he just didn't know what to do. So I think I wasn't the only one banking on him catching Stipe with a big shot and knocking him out. It looks to me like Ngannou and his camp were as well. Not exactly the ringing, glowing infomercial that UFEC wanted it to be for the UFC Performance Institute, where we were told that he was one of the best four athletes that the trainer there who's working with him, we're going to get into that another time, had ever seen, and the progressions and this and that. Turns out he was good for basically about 3 or 4 minutes, and then once Stipe started taking him down, wearing on him, and Stipe was tired too. Ngannou's still a big guy to move around. There were multiple times I thought if Stipe had more gas, he would have been able to get a finish by being more aggressive on the ground with his punches and not throwing them so soft just to kind of keep the position. But I thought he fought a brilliant fight. He is tough as nails. He dominated this fight, literally dominated this fight, and got a 50-44 on the judges, all three judges' scorecards. And quite frankly, it wasn't that close. What was also very interesting to me, keep in mind, Miocic makes history with this win by getting his third title defense. Being very honest, a healthy Cain Velasquez would be a nightmare for either one of these guys, especially, well, either one. I do question Cain's chin, I always have, and for good reason. And either one of these guys could knock Cain out, but if they don't, he'll have his way with either one of them. That said, third title defense in a row for Stipe sets the record for the heavyweight division. But what was very telling was when Buffer said, and still, etc., Miocic turned around, took the belt from Dana White, who always puts it around the champion's waist, took the belt from Dana White, handed it to his coach, who then put it around his waist. So there is clearly animosity and bad blood. Stipe talked about feeling disrespected, that the UFC wanted Nagano to win, which I completely agree with that they did. And clearly there is a bad relationship there with White, who he would not allow to put the belt around his waist. Just a stellar, stellar performance for Stipe Miocic, who came into this fight as an underdog to Francis Ngannou. We can all look back now and laugh at how ridiculous a notion that may have been. Also ridiculous that Daniel Cormier was a 3-1 favorite against Volkan Ozdemir. He should have been a 30-1 favorite. He TKOs him in the second after almost tapping him at the end of the first. Another stellar performance. The champions really showed up for this event. He, after getting outstruck a bit for the first 2 minutes, you know, Ozdemir, very aggressive. From that point forward, it is all Cormier until he TKOs him in the second, gets him in a crucifix, lands a bunch of punches. But this was a dominant performance. He outstruck Ozdemir after the first 2 minutes or so of the first round, landed some big shots that clearly hurt him, took him down twice. The first time he took him down in the first round, almost submitted him at the end of the round. He takes him down in the second, and it's all she wrote. So a fantastic performance for Daniel Cormier as well. And I have to give him credit. I loved his attitude coming into this fight, that he felt that he was not defending a belt, but that he was fighting for a vacant belt. With all the Jones drama and everything that John Jones put him through with the failed test, the losses, getting the belt back, and all this other up and down and up and down, I feel he validated himself again as the light heavyweight champion. Because Jones, how many times do you say, oh, it's with an asterisk, you know, put Jones on the side until he works through his latest set of problems, which, given that Jeff Nowitzki is his attorney and public relations guy, I expect that we'll see him back sooner than expected. But Daniel Cormier had a stellar performance, establishes himself as the champion again. Probably only a couple of fights left for him is my guess. I still think Alexander Gustafsson will give him hell, and that's the fight to make once Gustafsson heals up. Calvin Kattar just looked amazing against Shane Burgos, knocks him out in the third round. But this wasn't some, oh, he got lucky. He won the first round clearly. I also gave him the second round, although Burgos started to come on. Keep in mind, Burgos was 3-0 in the UFC, undefeated in his MMA career. But Kattar, I thought, had a dominant performance. The real story here was the jab. He was landing the jab constantly against Burgos. It was fight changing, but that was until the end. He lands a beautiful overhand right early in the third round that hurt Burgos. And as Burgos was kind of, you know, unsteady on his feet, he very patiently, very technically stepped back and landed a perfect uppercut that floored Burgos, and it was academic from there as he gets the TKO stoppage. Really, a stellar performance by Kattar. So all three of these fights, fantastic. I cannot say the same for Gian Villante's split decision win over Francimar Bajos 30-27 on two cards, as it should have been, 29-28 on one for Bohost, which is criminal. But it was a boring fight, and I'm not going to say much more about it. And another big performance on the main card by Rob Font. He knocks out Thomas Almeida in the second round, knocked him down, had him in trouble. Then he took him down, which I thought was a big mistake because he let Almeida recover. But then later in the round, he was able to land a head kick. That was the beginning of the end. Herb Dean was late, let Almeida take a couple of unnecessary shots on the ground, but Font gets the biggest win of his career. And on the prelims, one notable thing took place. Islam Makhachev knocks out Gleison Tibau in 57 seconds. Tibau, of course, had been out of the cage for an extended period of time, over 2 years, because of a USADA violation. We're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, we'll tell you what happened on Bellator and what's up next for the UFC.
Hey, it's Steve Austin. You're listening to Pro MMA Radio with Larry Pepe. And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so.
All right, as we head down the home stretch, our final segment this week brought to you by Cytosport Monster Milk. So, Bellator in the books. And yes, Rory McDonald is your welterweight champion. But not by much. A very close fight with Douglas Lima. 48-47 on one scorecard, 49-45 on another, and 49-46 on another. I thought it was 48-47. I thought Rory's fifth round, which was the clearest, most dominant round of the fight for either fighter, was really the difference. He sealed it with that round for me. Very strong performance. He said afterwards that Lima was the toughest fighter that he's ever fought, including everyone he ever fought in the UFC. And it looked like it. Lima hurt him with leg kicks. At one point, he took the front leg out from under him, and after the fight, McDonald said he really couldn't put much pressure on the leg. But McDonald's grappling too much. A couple of those rounds, very close, the close rounds for Lima. Like, I don't argue with the 49-46 score, simply because there were two very close rounds that I thought Lima edged out. So, however you want to score it, Rory McDonald now, your welterweight Bellator champion, but I don't think Douglas Lima loses much in the process. He loses the belt, of course. But in terms of credibility, I don't think he loses a whole lot. He is still an elite welterweight in the world. In the heavyweight tournament between a light heavyweight and a middleweight, turns out the middleweight wins, which is probably not bad for Bellator because Sonnen Kinsell gets a unanimous decision, 29-28 on all three cards. He got takedowns in all three rounds. Really, that was the story. You knew going in that that had to be the path, and Sonnen was able to pull it off. Rampage probably had him by approximately 30 pounds, but to his credit, his wrestling was too much. He took Rampage down as he needed to. He avoided the big shots, and he gets the W, and he moves on to face the winner of Fedor Mir, whenever the hell that happens. And I'm going to talk more next week about how I believe that Bellator has absolutely blown it, when they had a tremendous opportunity, truly, to pick up ground on the UFC. I think that they have blown it. And their mismanagement of this tournament is Exhibit A. Michael Chandler gets back in the win column. 30-26 on two cards, 30-25 on another. Just destroys Goichi Yamauchi, much too much for him, which shows that, yes, there are levels to this stuff, and he was at a different level. Grappling, wrestling, beating him up on the ground, really the story. And Aaron Pico KOs Shane Crutchen, beautiful body shot, beginning of the end, knocks him out in 37 seconds of the first round. So after dropping his first fight, he now has two beautiful knockouts. And we'll see what they do with him in terms of stepping him up competition-wise. So a decent night for Bellator, but boy, we will talk about them more next week. Last but not least, coming up next for the UFC on Fox, we have their next installment of the Fox series, and it will feature in the main event Derek Brunson versus Jacare in a rematch of a fight that took place in Strikeforce, where Jacare torched him. I believe it was in the first round. Of course, Brunson, definitely an improved fighter since then. Be interesting to see who Jacare is now, coming off the loss to Robert Whittaker. Of course, Jacare, absolutely elite on the ground. Brunson, a great wrestler. I don't think he's going to want to go to the ground. On the feet, I think Brunson is the better striker, but he also is, well, he's the better offensive striker, I believe, even though he got caught by Jacare in the first fight. But defensively, he leaves a lot to be desired. Still tends to get wild. I think it's a very interesting fight. Something tells me that Jacare may not be the same Jacare anymore, but that fight for me is a toss-up. In the co-main event, you have Andre Feely versus Dennis Bermudez. Let that sink in for a second and ask yourself if that should be a co-main event of a big Fox card, especially with Dennis Bermudez coming off of two losses in a row. I think by the fact that I'm asking the question, you already know my answer. And that brings us to the close of another episode of Pro MMA Radio, the official radio show of the American Forces Network. For all the incredible men and women listening to us on AFN, our sincerest thanks and prayers go out to all of you for everything you do. I'm running a bit short on time, so remember, you can catch us live next week right back here. Until then, have a kick-ass week, be safe, and that's a wrap.
You've been listening to Pro MMA Radio, your all-access pass to go beyond the fight. Make sure to visit ProMMARadio.com and full on-demand replays and show updates available 24/7. Come on, come on.